I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from the heart of the Redwoods and the legendary gold country town of Murphy's, California. Come along and join me for a visit with wine expert Gay Callen of Chatham Vineyards. Growing grapes and crafting fine wine since 1980, Callen is a legendary pioneer of the Sierra Foothills wine industry. Come along and join Miss Callen to discover the rest of the story.
Gay Callen, and I am the owner of Chatham Vineyards, which is located between Angels Camp and San Andreas in Calaveras County.
How cool. How did this happen for you to become a winemaker and a vintner and a grower?
To make a really long story short, the Chatham family came over in the early 1800s and landed in the Central Valley. And in the late 70s, 1970s, we were able to diversify. And I was born and raised in San Francisco, worked in a wine shop with some friends of mine. And the opportunity for putting in a vineyard was very attractive at the time.
Late 70s, what varietal did you think you were going to be good at?
I was working with computers. So I thought I would just be a weekend warrior wherever it was that we ended up. Mm-hmm. And we had a ranch consultant that knew Barden Stefano. And Barden had Stefano Winery up here and a vineyard. He was also working in real estate. So we connected with him.
He was one of the grandfathers of the modern iteration of the wine industry here. Yeah.
He was really the pioneer of getting all of this started in Calaveras County. Well, there is an older vineyard. I believe it's the Ghirardelli Vineyard. It was really Barden that started the wine industry and the boom.
The first iteration, what did the best? What varietals? What were you guys known for?
Well, I planted the vineyard for Stefano. Initially, he wanted Chardonnay, he wanted Sauvignon Blanc, he wanted Cabernet, Merlot, Zinfandel, and he wanted a little bit of Semillon to blend with the Sauvignon Blanc.
So Semillon back in the day would be for a Sauternes, right?
Well, were French, yes.
Yeah.
Over the course of any number of years, I go back 45 years on this. When we started crafting our Sauvignon Blanc, it was more of a melon characteristic, so that we did a blend, a slight blend with our Semillon. But the initial planting was for Barden. And so with that being said, he was buying fruit from El Dorado, from Amador County. We also had Chenin Blanc. All of a sudden, you know, Chenin Blanc became the poor man's Chardonnay. People were grafting like crazy to remove their Chenin, which is now a very popular varietal in the marketplace. So Barden started cutting back on the varietals that he wanted from our vineyard. So in the early 80s, 1980s, I started having wines made for me.
From your grapes.
From our grapes. And in the late 1980s, I don't know why we got this hairball idea of buying property and building our own winery. So while I was still furnishing some fruit to Stefano, we started building our own winery. And it was located on Highway 4 in Douglas Flat, which is now the Hatcher Winery. You know, kind of the rest is history. Everything that we crafted, we crafted from our own vineyard. I think the thing that really stands out with the history of winemaking here was the fact that nobody had heard of Calaveras County. They heard of Jumping Frog, Mark Twain. And so our history was more in gold and not in wine. So it was difficult, initially very difficult, to market a product that people were unfamiliar with the region. And it wasn't that we were just competing with Amador. We were the new kids on the block, so to speak.
But it would follow that, like San Francisco Chronicle Wine Competition. And
absolutely.
Those are the things that could propel you guys and make you.
Yeah. It did. We were lucky enough to have any number of awards from the San Francisco Chronicle tastings. We were in Variety Magazine. We were in Vanity Fair. We were fortunate enough to be at Williams-Sonoma Wine Club.
Wow.
And so we really did, mm-hmm. we were very fortunate in the success of where we were going.
Yeah.
Bringing in other interests was really fun because mm-hmm. Barden was really the one that spearheaded it. And we would go, he and I, and there was Chispa Sellers, who was Bob Bliss, who then sold to the Olsons, and then there was Steve and Liz Millier. We formed the Calaveras Wine Grape Alliance, so there might have been eight of us at the time. And we all agreed to disagree or not agree or or agree or whatever it was. It was a family. We were a family. And it still is a family. You know, all the wineries are family-owned mm-hmm. and operated.
So today, what is your AVA called? And
we don't have one.
You don't? Wow.
We don't have
one. You don't want one?
It's, well, no, we do. It's very expensive, though, to get the AVA. And uh-huh. we had looked into it when Barden was alive and, you know, when all of us were very... When it was very small, we looked into it.
But bottom line, whether you have the certification or not, you are by default a viticulture-growing region
yes.
that is distinctive.
Yes.
Different than your neighbors.
It is different. The topography, for us, you have vineyards at sea level. Copperopolis is sea level. And then you have up to Bryce Station, which is 3,000 feet. Mountain Ranch is a little bit higher. So you have limestone, you have beautiful sandy loam soils, you have total rock strata.
And you want rocks, yeah?
You do,
yeah.
You do.
What do they call
point.
About poor man's soil for,
pretty much.
For a rich man's wine?
Well, unfortunately, we seem to be growing rocks over the 45 years. So it can be very challenging mm-hmm. when you're trying to irrigate and you're not getting the water into the soil. What was really fun is to see the expansion, you know, when initially it was just three of us and then it was six of us. And now there are, I believe, 11 wineries, but 30-odd tasting rooms.
Interesting.
So a lot of the quote-unquote tasting rooms are having their wines crafted at the custom crush crafted at the wineries.
Interesting. So yourself... What do you have under estate rules that you're growing?
We did change the complexion of the vineyard over the course of the last 45 years. So we still have the Chardonnay. We are bringing back some of the Chenin that we had. We had Chenin that we grafted over to Merlot.
Mm-hmm.
So we're bringing back some of the Chenin.
Interesting.
We have Syrah.
Mm-hmm.
We have Sangiovese. We have Zinfandel, Semillon. I mentioned Merlot. We mm-hmm. do have Merlot. We have Cabernet. We have five Portuguese varietals. And we have, is that 13? I'm trying to remember how many we have. We just planted some Albarino uh-huh. for one of the local wineries and some Grenache.
Wow. So you can do a real breadth of different varietals.
We can.
Yeah.
We're in our own little valley.
So. Within your valley, are there little microclimates where you know one little acre might do better
yeah.
for one grape?
Yeah. Yeah. It's at the most northern portion of our vineyard, our soils are probably a good sandy loam, a good 8 to 10 feet deep, just gorgeous.
Isn't and that interesting that 500 yards away yeah. is a different wine?
It's, you know, I knew nothing about grapes. Mm-hmm. I didn't need another degree.
But
I did
you
go back
some
to
courses.
Davis. I did.
Yeah.
I went back to Davis and mm-hmm. learned how to put the correct end of a grapevine in the soil, which was, really? Is that how that works? You know, it's funny because people ask me if I would do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
I said, if I knew then what I know now,
yeah.
I would do it very differently.
But you would still do it.
I would still do it. We looked in Napa, and there's not a lot of areas where you can get up in the morning and you can see the sunrise. And then in the afternoon, you see the sunset. And we have had snow. We're at 1,500 feet. We've mm-hmm. had snow at the vineyard before. We've gotten through the drought.
Mm-hmm.
Water is always an issue for us. And right now there is a glut of fruit on the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it ebbs and flows. It's like a roller coaster ride.
Mm-hmm. But an interesting side, your reds, there's a long maturation process. You know, barrel aging.
Absolutely.
And bottle aging. So when it comes out the other end, it could be a different market.
When I had the winery, we worked more with the philosophy of old school. So that our reds, the heavier reds, the Merlots, the Cabernets, the Syrahs, would be in barrel anywhere from 24 to 36 months, then into bottle for a good year and a half to two. So by the time that we would release that wine, it was just beautiful. It was
just
elegant.
Prime.
It wasn't jammy, in-your-face kind of red. Our Sangiovese was more on the lighter style, so we always used neutral. But we were very mindful of not using certain formulas. And I think the vineyard itself and the topography and where things are planted, people would come back because they knew the quality the style of wine that they were going to get.
Yeah, but that implies patience because you're waiting another year or two for your return on investment. Some wineries can't afford.
Exactly. Cash flow. Cash flow is never easy.
But that can force you, maybe not you literally, but force you to push out a product sooner than you know it should wait.
Yes. You know, there's so many little gimmicks of aeration and you know, different things that different winemakers utilize to
push their envelope.
Push the envelope. And we didn't do that. And I think that was
so you were an old school purist then.
Kind of. If you'd ask my dad, he was a martini drinker, and so by the time he would have a glass of wine, he would call me and say he didn't like it. Which, okay, after a martini I wouldn't either. You know, I left that part of the industry because I had been on the road so much. It was time for me to let it go. And we had a great wine club, and we had a great time. It was also a good time to move it forward and come back to being a farmer.
Interesting. Although I got to interject for a moment, a wine club is a real brilliant model to reduce and simplify. I mean, you don't have to do the dog and pony show to go on the road, sales and whatnot, nearly as much if you have an in-house consumption of your wine.
That's very true. I think that you know, now with I still belong to a number of wine clubs here locally because I want to support the industry here. I sell fruit to a number of the wineries here, and I think it's important that we maintain the friendships but also the knowledge. I mean, as a grower, you know, we maintain the knowledge of who's crafting what and how are they crafting it. You're right. Wine clubs are the icing on the cake.
Brilliant. A friend of mine owns a winery down around Paso, and that was his godsend during COVID.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he just chugged on.
Yeah, you have to get. We noticed, and I think that when I said there is a glut of fruit on the market, COVID affected. Even though people were drinking, a lot. People
yeah,
were
you
drinking
think they're doing more.
It really affected sales to the point where that now we're feeling it. The grower is feeling it at this juncture. Over the years, you know, having any number of people come to us when we had the winery, and then come to me asking me about what did they think of, you know, what kind of grape to plant or whatever. It's a beautiful community. It is spacious. Every area is totally different. Like, we're 8 miles outside of Angel's Camp in San Andreas, so I'm just over the hill from Murphy's. So I want to stay where I am, you know, in lieu of, oh, well, why don't you buy this piece of property and plant something over there? I said, I've got enough on my plate right now. But bringing more people into the region, over the years, it's not just Chardonnay and Cabernet and Merlot anymore. You have the Tempranillos, you have the Barberas, you have, I think there's close to 50 different varietals that we have here now.
But is there one or two that are synonymous with what you guys in your local area are best at? That's a tough one?
It is a tough one. I mean, the Foothills is known for their Zinfandel, whether it's in Amador or not. I think that Tempranillo has come up, and I know that Barden and Unfortunately, both Barden and Chuck Hovey are no longer with us, but they really introduced the Tempranillo to the community and region, and that does very well here.
It's fascinating what you're saying, because the classic Spanish varietal would do great, as would Central Northern France varietal. Your reds. I mean, that's fascinating.
Pinots do not do well up here, because it's not a cool enough, damp enough. I mean, you know, Pinots thrive with fog and, you know, Carneros thing.
So it's closer to the coast where they do better.
Yes.
In Northern California.
You know, when people say, oh, don't plant Chardonnay, our Chardonnay has just done so well. And our Sauvignon Blanc is a beautiful Sauvignon Blanc. It has more of a melon characteristic to it than that bone dry, grassy, you know, Sauv Blanc.
Is your Chardonnay a Muente clone?
No, it's actually all of our fruit is on its own rootstock.
Oh, cool.
Which is kind of scary because, because way back when, you know, phylloxera has always...
Yeah, you weren't supposed to do that.
You weren't supposed to do that. But you know, Murphy's Law, anything could go wrong. I did. We didn't end up with... I better be knocking on wood with phylloxera.
Yeah,
we're very mindful of the equipment we bring in or who's coming in, you know, if for no other reason. I don't want to pull it all out.
Okay, if you have time, I have an aside for you.
Okay.
This probably will cut it out. I spent time in Missouri, a region called Augusta, Missouri. You ever heard of it?
I think so.
Augusta is the first AVA in America, oldest.
I'll bet.
Who would guess that?
Yeah.
One of the reasons why is the little brilliant winemaker guy is the one that figured out that his rootstock was immune, which they shipped millions of roots back to France and saved the French wine industry. I know. And then that guy wound up coming out here and one of the founders of the Napa in our area. And I'm spacing on his name now, but you can look it up.
That is fascinating.
It really is such an unknown story. Ask any one of your friends, what's America's oldest AVA? And not one will know.
No. You know, it's being in the East Coast, when I would go to tasting, there would be a wine from North Carolina. There would be a wine from Missouri. There would be a wine from, well, Michigan. They have the ice wines. And we had, Mari Wells was one of our winemakers at the time. And so it was an all women. It was all women winery, which was really fun. We had we had a ball. She was investigating different vinifera and talking about, you know, this and that. And I'm just looking at her going, I've never heard of that. I've never heard of that. So when I went to Michigan to do a tasting and I went to these different tables, and it was really fascinating what they make wine out of anywhere. And I think every state of the union now has some sort of grape. So,
well, and the other interesting dynamic, I interviewed the owner of the oldest winery in Virginia, and it's this legendary place. And I said, "What's your favorite wine that you make?" And he goes, "My favorite is beer." He said, "I don't like the wine that we make because our customer base likes a sweet wine, and I don't like sweet wines."
I think there's an old adage that a winemaker will drink a lot of beer to make a really good wine. You know, and there was always a six pack somewhere in our refrigerator in the cellar, but it's. I miss that part of crafting, being able to sample, and with the Cabernet, there were years that we would just do 100% Cab, and years that we would do a blend of the Merlot, you know, to it. But I think that overall, looking back, I'm delighted to see how the region has grown with the quality of fruit and the quality of winemaking.
Do you see younger people coming in trying to do startups and grow the industry here locally? Or is it kind of static?
That's a really good question. I think that I know that one of our buddies just sold his winery to someone out of the Bay Area, and they know nothing about it. I believe that they're a little bit younger.
Right. Well, if they don't know anything, they don't have any fear.
No, you're correct. Neither did I when I came up here. I had no fear.
If you knew now, what
and
you
I
knew
did, and it's like I said, if I knew then what I know now, it would be a little bit different.
Yeah.
I don't see a tremendous amount of youth coming into it. I have four children that We're out in the field. We're over at the winery. We're, you know, doing barrels, doing pruning and all of that. And let's see, two are teachers. One is a dean of students. One works for the government, and one works for a nonprofit.
Oh, how funny. You know? They all learned their lesson.
They did. They love the ranch. They do love the ranch.
Yeah, and they still come back.
They still come back, and they have kids, and the kids just look at the tractors. And
So you don't make them into baby cellar rats, the kids?
No.
You could.
It'd be fun to have them on tractors, you know, when we're pruning or when we're harvesting. Yeah. But unfortunately, you know, they're all busy doing doing their other things.
You contract out for your harvest?
We do. Uh-huh. You really have to have contract labor up here.
And is it all hand?
It is. Everything that we do is hand cultivated, hand picked because of when we planted.
Your spacing.
And also just the topography itself.
Yes. Yeah, the tractors would tip over.
It doesn't lend itself to machine harvesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
One of the things when we opened the winery, Ironstone, the Couts family was just building their facility, and I think that was also another incredible draw for people to see what capabilities we had.
Mm-hmm.
And I really
so you were a pioneer in modern iteration.
Yes. You know, with working with Barton Stevenot and then branching out and doing it on our own, there were any number of gentlemen coming over from Amador and coming to the vineyard and looking at me going, "You're never going to make it. You know, a woman doesn't make it in this industry." This is in the early 1980s. Yeah. And I'm like, okay. And we're all very dear friends, still very dear friends, but I'm still at it.
I interviewed the founder of Paraiso Springs Winery in the San Lucia Highlands. And I go, I think it was Richard, I go, "You were one of the pioneers of the Monterey County vintners, you know, modern iteration in the 70s. That's so cool." He says, "Yeah, us pioneers, we're the ones that have arrows in our asses." He'd plant 20 acres or something he thought would do great. And 5 years later, they're tearing out the 20 and planting something else.
It was, when referring to the Couts family, I think it gave other people, you know, whether they made money in tech or computers or what, upside down cakes or whatever it was, it gave them the opportunity because properties here were less expensive than going to Napa or Sonoma or elsewhere. But they have brought so many people to our region and introduced so many people to just the wine industry, the vineyard industry. They, along with Barton, have really brought a lot here. I can't say that I have. I mean, I'm one of the old timers, but
Maybe you're being modest too.
You know, I've had friends that have moved up here, and friends that have been over in the Napa area that have sold their property and come up here and or gone to Amador County. But I think that seeing the quality and seeing the style of building and crafting that all of us have been able to do is really—it's added something to this community itself, and it's not just Murphy's. It's, you know, McCallumy Hill. It's Angel's Camp. It's San Andreas Mountain Ranch.
We could go on and on, but I'm gonna have to come back and we'll go out and kick tires on the back 40.
Yeah, cool. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. How do we learn more about your world?
Oh, that's a really good question.
Do you have a website?
We do. It's Chatham Vineyards. You know, Chatom Vineyards with an S.com.
That's too easy.
Yeah, it is. It is easy. And my name is Gay Callen.
Awesome. What a pleasure. This has been fun. And I want to go out and kick some dirt clods with you.
Well, when you come back, we'll have to have you out to the ranch.
I would love
it. It really is breathtaking.
All right. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you up here in the back 40.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
World Bicycle Relief partners with communities to deliver specially designed, locally assembled rugged bicycles for people in need. Nearly 1 billion people in rural regions of the world live in communities far from the nearest paved road, walking miles every day just to survive. Distance is a barrier to attending school, receiving health care, delivering goods to market, and other critical services needed to thrive. Find out how you can help deliver rugged, dependable, life-changing bicycles to deserving communities. Log on to worldbicyclerelief.org to learn more.